Who your birth parents are? Are they still alive?
One of them is, maybe. I don't know. I'm sorry I brought it up. I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, Prager said, feeling bad that she didn't yet trust him with that kind of personal information. Who's playing at First Avenue this month? She asked, making it clear that the previous topic was off the table. Of course he knew every band that was playing through October. Just then, he really didn't feel like naming off all the ones he'd even consider seeing. But it was clear that's what she wanted to talk about, not the stuff that was emotionally important to her. So we went with it, and I ended up talking about music nonstop for pretty much the whole rest of the drive. It was a good thing that Eva was tall and strong, because they needed two people to untie that heavy wooden canoe from the car and portage it to the pier. It felt like one of the last days of summer with just a bit of chill coming off the massive lake, and the water was clustered with motorboats and canoes. When he looked at the empty parts of the beach, he imagined that they were 1850s pioneers, paddling to find a new homestead in Ojibwe country. It turned out that getting in a canoe was way harder than it looked. Plus, sitting on those little benches in the thing was kind of precarious. Prager forgot to bring life jackets. Lucky for them, walleye were usually caught close to shore. Eva had no qualms about digging her hand into a styrofoam cup of nightcrawlers and piercing one of those struggling little guys twice through with a fish hook. It made him think of his mom. The handful of times they'd gone fishing as a family, she'd always baited her own hooks, even when they were using leeches. She'd been a straight-A student in her teens, but liked motorcycles and baseball and dive bars and getting her hands dirty. She was awesome like that. It was something to watch Eva's hands on his mom's old rod doing the same things he'd only seen one other woman do before, impaling a feisty nightcrawler twice through. He got really sad all of a sudden, and it must have shown in his eyes. Eva glanced up at him. "Don't look so upset," she said in a half-joking tone. "It's a law of the universe. You gotta kill things in order to live." Prager took a deep breath as he pulled a worm from the cup, going along with the pretense that it was the worm killing that disturbed him, as wimpy as that made him seem. After an hour, they caught one golden brown striped fish that was kind of small, and they put him back. Prager swore it was a baby walleye. Eva seemed fairly sure it wasn't. After another hour of drowning worms and losing them in little nibbles, it was almost 5 p.m., and supposedly the best time to catch walleye was in the evening. Clearly, they were just too eager and had started too early. Finally, around 5:30, Eva's red and white bobber plunked below the water, and her thin green rod bowed with an invigorating weight. It was another one of the golden brown guys, beautiful and gasping, held aloft by his lips, urgently splattering the air. He was small, but still bigger than the last one, and Eva and Prager were hungry for any kind of victory. Prager couldn't speak for Eva, obviously, but he wanted to get the fishing and grilling and eating part over with, so they could start making out again and he could more vigorously touch the boobs he had just sort of grazed last time. Prager was at the ready, with the blue Playmate cooler full of melting ice, to meet the fish as Eva swung it into the boat, unhooked its lips, and closed the lid on their quarry. For some reason, they high-fived afterwards. Until that moment, he had looked askance at people who called fishing a sport, but the catharsis of it all made it feel like they'd somehow competed and won.
"Well, that might be big enough for both of us," Prager said. "Want to call it?"
"Oh, come on," she said. "I think we can get more." He was actually a little afraid that she would get super into it. They'd been out on the lake for 3 hours at that point, and Prager figured that this part of the mission was now clearly accomplished, but she acted like they were just getting going.
"How much can we eat anyway?" he asked.
"One more, come on," Eva said. "After all the work getting here?" In the end, the one was all they caught. And when they lifted the wet canoe out of the water, the sun was setting. They stopped a bearded guy in a vest who was lugging a large cooler across the parking lot and asked him,
where they could grill their fish. He asked how many they had, and Prager showed him.
"This a walleye, right?" Prager asked.
The bearded guy looked as if you'd just asked him whether Kirby Puckett was a man or a woman.
"Nope," he said. "That's a yellow perch."
"Is it edible?"
"Oh, sure," the guy said. "It's a panfish.
Great eating."
The guy directed them to a nearby park in the city of Isle with outdoor grills. It looked like an awesome place to have sex for the first time, because it was free and had trees and a view of the lake, but there were a ton of people there. Prager decided he'd get to work on the fire as Eva dug a pan and a steak knife out of her grocery bag.
"Good thing I just learned how to fillet a fish," Eva said. "The one thing I could really use, though, is an actual fillet knife."
"Where did you learn to fillet?" Prager asked, shoving balled-up newspaper between the charcoal briquettes like his dad taught him once.
"At the steamboat."
"Oh, really?"
"Yeah, it's awesome. Everyone there is super nice. They let me help with a whole bunch of stuff. Prime rib, lobster, walleye."
"How many times have you been there?"
"Not counting the time with you, 3 more times."
"Did they hire you to work there or something?"
"I'm sort of their kitchen intern, which is awesome. Everyone there is teaching me a bunch of stuff. There's this one cook, Maureen O'Brien. She's super nice. She's letting me do all of her prep work."
"How much are they paying you?"
"I said I'd work for free. I offered."
"Sounds like slave labor."
"No, it's not. They give me dinner. That's more than fine with me. And I get to take home food for my dad. And Job said he's going to try to get me a real kitchen job. If not there, then somewhere really cool. He says I have a once-in-a-generation palate."
"I think he's just trying to get in your pants is what I think."
"You know what? Fuck you," Eva said.
Prager almost felt like he'd lost his balance. People had said this to him before, but this was different. He had hurt somebody, and she had hurt him back. But he was still right. He was sure of it.
"I'm just saying, he didn't pay any attention to me last Thursday."
"He's with somebody, for your information."
"That doesn't matter. Men don't care about that."
"And you would know that how?" This was totally sucking ass. He wanted to make her apologize for not telling him what she was up to, not finger himself as the unfaithful pervert that Job probably was.
"How come you didn't ever tell me you were going down there?"
"You never asked. You never asked me what I did yesterday or last night or anything. I ask you about your day, and then you go off on a tangent about it."
"No, I don't," he said. "I've asked you how your day was tons of times."
"That's not how I remember it."
"Well, I have, totally."
"Have it your way, then," she said.
"How's it going with the fire over there? I need to heat the pan up before I put the oil in."
The perch fillets were lightly breaded and spitten in the pan before Prager realized that he was the one who had better apologize if he was going to get so much as a kiss out of this whole sorry day. She accepted the apology, but when they sat next to each other on the picnic table and ate their pan-fried yellow perch in the dark, she was quiet.
"This is way fresher than anything you could get at the steamboat," Prager said at one point.
"Actually, it's about the same," Eva said.
"Really?" Prager said. "They're right on the lake where the fish is from?"
"Why'd you stiff the waitress on our date, by the way? Job says you left her like a dollar."
"I left her every dollar I brought."
"If you knew where we were going, you should have brought more."
"Well, I didn't know you were going to order such expensive shit."
"It's getting late," she said,
shoving the rest of the fish in her mouth.
"We should get back."
She fell asleep in the car on the way home. Prager tried to tell himself it was because she was just that comfortable with him. But when he dropped her off and she just hugged him, he felt like an 18-wheeler had driven off a cliff and landed on his heart. He went home and turned off the lights in his room and put on the song Why by Annie Lennox, the MTV Unplugged version, the one he got on a mix CD from one of his ex-girlfriends, and put it on repeat. He felt that fucking sad. He stared up at the Radiohead poster on his ceiling and felt the lyrics echo in his heart like a penny tossed down an empty well.
Why was this boat sinking? They had barely even started rowing, but it was. He needed to text her and apologize again, but it was 12:20 at night. Finally, he thought he should just see if she was up, and if she was, he'd apologize. At 12:22, he texted, "You up?" and stared at the little screen on his flip phone, waiting for her response until 12:45, when he finally plugged the phone back into the charger and turned the ringer off and closed his eyes. The next morning, he was woken up at noon by his dad grabbing his foot. "You forgot to take the canoe off the car," Eli said. "I had to drive it to church and back with a canoe on it."
"Oh," Prager said, "sorry."
"Pat's coming over for dinner in 5 hours. Have the canoe off the car by then. And dress yourself nice." Vic Gupta was over at Ken Kovac's house, jamming in the garage they used as a practice space, when Prager drove there to give the canoe back. Vic and Ken were deeply unimpressed with him when he told them the story of his fishing trip with Eva.
"You blew it," Vic said. "You had a woman on a boat, even, and you didn't execute."
"Have you been in a canoe?"
"Anywhere where two people can fit, they can have sex. It's the law."
"So what the fuck you gonna do now?" Ken asked.
Prager had known Ken for longer, and Ken was a little more invested in Prager's emotional life journey.
"I don't know," Prager said. "I already called her today and left her a message and left her a text both last night and this morning."
"Maybe call her again and apologize again."
Vic got up from his drum stool.
"Ken, weren't you listening? He got hugged at the end of a second date. Hugged. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Seriously, you'd rather get slapped in the face than hugged."
"Yeah, that's true," Ken said. "You can work with getting slapped in the face. There's a lot of emotion there. You just have to flip the dime."
"Prager, here's what you should do tomorrow. Flowers, chocolate, and another gift, something personal. Something only the two of you would know. And have you written her a song yet?"
"Yeah, I started."
"Well, get on it tonight, master it, play it for her ASAP.
"What if I have to skip band practice again tomorrow?"
Vic and Ken glanced at each other.
"This is an alt-country band," Vic said. "All this heartache is comme il faut. Jeff Tweedy would kill for a week like this. You might get a whole album of lyrics from just yesterday alone."
Ken nodded. "Go get him out there." Prager was in his bedroom practicing Steamy Night on a Steamboat when his dad knocked on the door. Prager had lost track of time. It was 4:56.
"She's here," Eli said, smiling. "Come out and say hi."
No way this woman was 35. Maybe 55. She had thick legs, wrinkles around her eyes, and gray hairs sprouting from her hairline. She was smiling, but Prager could totally tell it was a fake smile just to be polite. She had a large orange ceramic baking pan with her covered in cellophane, and there were two more unfamiliar dishes on the dining room table already.
"What is all this?" Prager said.
"Pat's made a home-cooked meal for our entire family," Eli said.
It was disturbing enough to walk out into the living room on a Sunday afternoon in the fall and not hear a lurid NFL game chundering from the TV, much less to feel a cheerless, significant silence, and to see the strange woman and all of her food and all of its invasive smells filling the empty spaces in their raw home. Pat Jorgensen extended her hand. "So nice to meet you, Will," she said. "I've heard so much about you."
"Yeah, okay," Prager said.
"Only the good things," Eli said, patting his son on the back, which he pretty much never did ever. "Julie!" Eli shouted. "Just a minute, Dad! God!" came a girl's voice from behind a closed bedroom door. Eli glanced at Pat as if to say, "Teenagers." "Please be seated. Pat, may I get you something to drink? I bought a bottle of Chardonnay."
"Just water for now, thank you."
"Well, if you want any white wine, help yourself. I hear it goes with seafood."
Prager had never heard his dad say anything close to those sentences in his entire life.
Okay, where's the seafood?
Pat made tuna casserole, in the orange pan.
You know I'm a vegetarian, Dad.
Pat looked at Eli but avoided his eye contact.
Oh, I'm sorry, your father didn't tell me.
You just went fishing yesterday, Eli said. You can't be that much of a vegetarian, just pick out all the fish if you have to. Julie came out of her room wearing a Minnesota Vikings jacket zipped all the way up, pink hot pants, and a Lone Ranger mask. Eli shook his head. Julie, this is what I want to wear.
Nice jacket, Pat said.
I don't care what you think, Julie said. Why is she sitting in Mom's chair?
Pat looked at Eli.
I should switch chairs with you.
Eli didn't move, except to look Julie in the face. At least take the mask off.
If the mask goes, I go.
Pat touched Eli's hand.
It's fine.
Eli said, we should say grace.
We don't say grace in this family, Dad, Julie said.
It's okay, Eli, said Pat.
Prager lifted his wine glass.
L'chaim, he said.
So what is all this repugnant garbage? Julie asked.
Julie, Eli said, be nice.
Why? I don't want to be here.
Remember what I said? No sports for a week?
Sounds like a deal to me. Can I go now?
No, just 5 minutes. Just tell Pat something about yourself. She's heard a lot about you guys and wants to get to know you better.
I just got my first period last month, Julie said.
Prager laughed. He couldn't help it. Pat pursed her lips as she passed around the au gratin potatoes she had made.
Julie.
Julie twisted a slotted spoon around in a casserole dish.
What's this?
Au gratin potatoes, Pat said.
Rotten potatoes? Looks like it.
Prager laughed again.
Eli pounded his fist on the table. Julie, both of you!
Pat looked up.
She can leave if she wants.
Julie immediately got up from the table.
God, thank you!
Eli pointed to her.
Don't leave your room.
Julie slammed her bedroom door and put on the song My Neck, My Back by Kia, and turned it up real loud. Prager started to laugh again. Eli almost got up from the table, but Pat restrained him.
Don't, she said, just ignore it.
Will, tell Pat about your country music band, Eli said.
Well, I'm actually really busy writing a song tonight, Prager said, for a girl.
Well, you should get to it after dinner.
Mind if I go and just work on it right now? I'm kinda in the zone.
Sure, Pat said. I'll make you a plate.
Prager was going to say that's okay, but she seemed so eager to get Eli's unpleasant children out of the dining room, she had piled up the tuna casserole, boiled string beans, and potatoes au gratin on his plate before he could object. Prager didn't look at his dad when he took the plate and left the dining room. Pat said something like, nice to meet you, which he didn't respond to. And the first thing he did when he got to his room was dump the plate in the garbage. It was actually real hard to write a song on the acoustic guitar with that dirty hardcore rap song playing in the background, but Prager wasn't about to declaw his sister's protest. For a moment, he tried to think of a day when he'd felt closer to Julie, when he'd loved her more. And only the day of their parents' accident came to mind. An hour later, his dad was still somehow eating dinner with that woman, and Prager was starving, but he'd also finished Steamy Night on a Steamboat, and was at last ready to play it for Eva. Her cell phone went straight to voicemail. He took a deep breath and tried her house phone. It rang a long time. Finally, her dad answered. He sounded wasted.
Yeah, Jarl said.
Hi, this is Will Prager. Is Eva home?
Nope, Jarl said. She's working that restaurant job.
Seemed weird for that late on a Sunday evening.
Okay, can you tell her to call me as soon as she gets home?
Yeah, sure, Jarl said. Are you the guy whose band plays Jimmy Buffett tunes?
Will was dismayed at Jarl's memory of their brief interaction, but he wasn't in the mood to have this particular conversation.
Yeah, he found himself saying, and I gotta go. I gotta get to practice.
Next time you play, make me a VHS tape of it so I can see you guys, Eva's dad said.
We will, Prager said for some reason, realizing that he had no idea how he could make that happen even if he wanted to.
I'll tell her Jimmy called,
Jarl said, and laughed before he hung up. Prager stopped her in the hall before fifth period. Her hair was up, she wasn't wearing any makeup, and she looked tired. Even the white t-shirt she was wearing, which read Lark Managed Services and looked like a promotional giveaway shirt from a company picnic or something, seemed out of character.
How come you haven't returned any of my texts or my calls? He asked her.
I was going to. I've just been super busy.
Too busy to even return a text? What's up with that?
So, what do you want to tell me?
I want to play you the song I wrote you.
I don't know if I have the time for that today, she said, leaning against the lockers in the hallway. I gotta work at the store after school every day this week.
Well, maybe after you get off work, then. What time is that?
7, she said.
I'll call you at 7:15.
Why do you have to work every day? Are you trying to avoid me or something? My dad got fired from his job, she said. So I gotta pick up all the shifts I can. It's not about you at all. She glanced at the doorway to their history classroom. I guess we better get to class. He sat in the front row for an hour watching Killer Keeley talk about the French and Indian War and tried to think of his next move. Vic Gupta would know exactly what he should do, but he couldn't talk to Vic until after school. She was obviously not so excited to see him like she used to be, but one thing was still certain. If he could just figure out a way to play Steamy Night on a Steamboat for her today, she'd fall in love with him in a second. By the end of class, he'd decided that this was the only plan that would work. At 7:15 p.m. and 9 seconds, Prager called Eva's cell, and once again it went straight to VM. He tried her apartment and no one answered. A machine didn't even pick up. He tried again 3 minutes later and got the same result. He tried one more time at 7:25, and nothing had changed. It rang and rang 11, 12, 13 times. He threw his guitar in his dad's car and drove south toward Prescott. The built-to-spill tape was still in the tape deck, and he just let it keep going. It might as well be the damn soundtrack to everything. He didn't know where the Steamboat Inn's kitchen was, so he went inside and asked the head waiter, a young fat blonde woman with a ponytail, who said that he could either get there through the employees-only door by the bathroom or through the door on the side of the building by the employee parking lot. He said thanks, and while he was standing there, he noticed the waitress from his date standing by the bar putting cocktails on a tray, and he went up to her and put a $10 bill between the drinks.
Sorry about last time, he said.
From the look on her face, it didn't seem like she even recognized him. Prager picked up his guitar from the back seat and walked around back to the employee lot and saw that the black wooden door to the kitchen was swung all the way open. Between Prager and the kitchen, there was just a heavy-looking black metal screen door, and even from a distance, he could see a lot of what was happening inside. It was really bright in there. A stark hospital white light from above, and way less fancy than he would have guessed a kitchen like that would look. There were big silver basins and spigot heads on long snakes and black rubber mats on the floor with holes in them. There were maybe 6 or 7 people in there, all wearing white, all terribly busy cutting meat, tossing salad, peeling fruit. He saw Eva in there, in her new style of a white t-shirt and pants with a lot of pockets, standing next to a woman he didn't recognize who was dressed exactly the same way. Maybe that Maureen O'Brien person. And they were peeling something over a silver bowl and laughing. It was too bright in there for them to see clearly outside, and no one so much as looked in his direction. He walked to his car, put the guitar in the back seat, and got the sexy grandpa beer koozie out of the glove box where he'd left it for good luck. He came back to the screen door and quietly crammed the beer koozie in around eye level in the space between the frame and the screen. She found him the next morning before school by the vending machines. "Let's go for a walk," she said.
"How did you know where to find me?" he asked her.
"Your friends told me this is where you hang out," she said.
They walked outside, past where all the heavy metal dudes smoke cigarettes, all the way to the highway almost.
"Well, I got your message of sorts last night."
"Yeah?"
"So is that it? Are you done with me?"
"I'm assuming you're done with me. You tell me you're going to be home at 7:15 and you're not. That's totally shitty."
"The restaurant called me and wanted me to come in."
"You could at least call me and tell me that your plans have changed."
"I admit that was careless of me, and I'm sorry. But part of it is that I just don't know if I can handle you right now."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"I don't think you're ready for what you want," she said.
"How would you know?"
"You know, maybe I don't. But either way, you're like the most intense guy of all time, really. It's a lot, okay? I'm just saying, take it easy. I'll be here."
"You'll be here?"
"But in the meantime, let's just be friends."
Prager had heard that one before, and pretty much learned to turn off what a girl said after she said that because it was all bullshit. He didn't talk to her before fifth period or sit next to her during seventh period anymore. But they still said hi when they passed each other in the halls, out of politeness, he guessed, but that was it. To other people in class, no one could probably tell they'd ever kissed, that he wrote a song for her, and that she'd been the last thought on his mind every night. At home, meanwhile, Eli, Julie, and even that awful Pat who was around all the time now, they all knew what was up. And he didn't try to hide it from them either, mostly because it made it easier for him to be curt and disagreeable without being hassled. He had to quit listening to Built to Spill, Neutral Milk Hotel, Annie Lennox, Mazzy Star, Soul Coughing, and all the other bands that reminded him of her even a little bit. But his own band got more of his time, and they even scheduled a gig for December at the rec center where he used to see smarmy kitten shows. Alone in his bedroom, he helplessly ruminated on what she said, specifically the phrases, "not ready," and "I'll be here." As the weeks passed with this in mind, he remained calm and respectful and not intense. By mid-November, he and Eva were even in the same eight-person group in history class, pretending to be delegates from the four southern colonies. And the day before Thanksgiving, she even touched him on the arm, twice. He talked to Vic Gupta about it over Thanksgiving break, and the first Monday back in school, he went in 20 minutes before the first bell to wait by her locker. He couldn't wait another second. He'd only been there a few minutes when Eva, surprised to see him, smiled and said, "Hey." She was wearing her winter outfit of a thrift store duster and floppy black stocking cap, no makeup, no painted fingernails.
"Hey," Prager said.
"I just want you to know I'm ready now." Eva looked at him a little puzzled. "Okay, ready for what?"
"You want to go on another culinary adventure this Friday?"
She looked at him for what felt like 30 seconds, and then down at the floor, and then back at him. "I'm moving," she said.
"Oh," he said.
With each second that her words and everything they meant were hanging in the air, threatening to be true, he started to feel like she was taking the school apart brick by brick and throwing the bricks at his heart.
"When?"
"This weekend." Prager could feel he was losing all ability to remain composed in the face of these words, but his mouth kept trying.
"Where?" he asked.
She looked at the ground and continued talking. "Maureen moved to a restaurant in the cities, and she can get me a full-time job there."
"Full-time job," was all he could say.
Well, my dad lost his job here and can't find a new one, so it's kind of my family's best option.
So what high school are you going to?
He surprised himself at summoning such a long, coherent sentence.
I figure I'll get a GED.
I don't need to waste my time in high school anyway. It's not like I want to go to college or something.
No offense if you do.
Oh, he said. It sounded nuts to him. Who didn't go to college? The nonsense of this idea emboldened him a little.
So you're just going to be a chef in a restaurant?
She didn't seem to respond. He noticed just then that she wasn't taking out her books and materials for one class, but rather was emptying out her entire locker into her backpack.
It was illuminating, Will Prager, she said, looking at him. I think of our steamy night on a steamboat often.
You do? He asked.
She nodded. Well, she said. Later.
He watched her pull the heavy black backpack over her shoulders and walk down the hall, her smooth brown hair and black stocking cap drawing his stare until the very end, until she turned a corner toward the exit, when old Mrs. Colwell, who'd just exited her freshman English classroom, turned and stared at him, forcing Prager to glance away. When he looked again at the space where Eva last was, she was gone. He needed to get out too right now, but he couldn't leave by the same doors. Head down, he walked to the other end of the hall and left, pushing through a busload of underclassmen who were no doubt staring at his red eyes filling with tears. Prager made it outside, face and body in the cool, clammy 40-degree late autumn air, and kept walking across the grass and soft brown leaves and concrete, and was off school grounds for almost half a block, passing a squat yellow house with an American flag out front before he realized that he, unlike Eva Torvald, had left the building for no real purpose, and had nowhere to go, and nowhere else to be in the world besides the place he just left. He turned back toward the school, thought of the lyrics to Reason to Believe, the Tim Hardin song made famous by Rod Stewart, and stood there, waiting in the cold for his feet to move, and sooner or later they did.
Golden Bantam. While parked down the street from her boyfriend Mitch's townhouse, waiting for his wife's car to pull out of the garage and leave for work, Octavia Kincaid stared at the plastic pink flamingo sticking out of the snow in his neighbor's yard and had what her former therapist would have called a moment of clarity. It was all Eva Torvald's fault, she realized. All of it. Not just the fact that she was freezing to death in a god-awful Pontiac Aztec with a busted heater, but her frustrating lack of commitment from former Bar Garocha executive chef Mitch Diego, her two kids with Adam Snelling, her marriage to Adam Snelling, the breakup of the Sunday night dinner party, even what happened to Lacey Deitch. Eva's presence had set all of this in motion. As she awaited the text from Mitch's second cell phone, which he used just for her, she looked through her frosty windshield at the snow falling for the second time that April and, like those stupid ironic flamingos, felt imprisoned by the cruelty of circumstances beyond her control. It wasn't any colder outside the car, so she figured she would maybe wait outside, maybe even lie down in the snow by the flamingos without her jacket on. Was it possible to die of hypothermia in April? Probably, if it was still below freezing out. Maybe she would be the first. As she lay down in the clammy snow and felt it soak the back of her jeans and wool sweater and hair that she just spent over 20 minutes on, she was sure that whether she survived or not, it would send that bastard a message. Look at what you drove me to do. 5 years ago, Octavia would have known better. For starters, she should have known not to extend a warm, welcoming hand to a helpless creature like Eva Torvald. But Octavia was a nice person with a big, generous heart who felt sorry for outsiders and tried to help them. And people like her never get any thanks for their selflessness. They are not the ones with the hardness to make others wait. They are the ones left waiting, until their souls are broken like old bread and scattered in the snow for the birds. They can go right ahead and aspire to the stars, but the only chance they'll ever have to fly is in 1,000 pieces, melting in the hot guts of something predatory. It was the last July weekend of 2009, in the deep, sticky bulge of summer, and Robbie was having some people over at the house near Lake Calhoun that he bought on a short sale and then exhaustively modernized. The kitchen was outfitted with marble countertops, a center island, 2 recessed refrigerators, each with a glass door, a hatch in the floor that led to the basement wine cellar, and a painfully tasteful version of every necessary or desired piece of kitchen hardware. Octavia, who was 26 at the time, didn't know anyone else around her age with such a pimped-out kitchen, but Robbie Kramer was unusual among her friends. He was 29, shaved his face every day, and had graduated from Carleton back in 2002, the perfect time to join a mortgage loan firm and start slinging subprimes to the masses like pancakes at a charity breakfast. She didn't know him back then, and had a hard time believing that the collection of Chateauneuf-du-Pape beneath her feet were purchased on the backs of foreclosed blue-collar families and fixed-income seniors. She asked him about it once, in those terms. He just replied, "Were you there?" and looked at her as if she'd just flipped off a mall Santa in front of the children. By 2009, that revenue model no longer existed, of course, but Robbie had already cashed out. While he watched his bosses get taken to court, he got a realtor's license, took cooking classes, and sold the treatment for a memoir called An Arm and a Leg, One Young Man's Ride on the Bubble. Robbie's life and home were truly impressive, but she wasn't going to embarrass herself gushing over every little magnetic knife rack or hobnailed sand iron tetsubin. When Octavia first walked into the kitchen, Robbie was literally explaining a pressure cooker to a young, gawky tower of a girl, and she was acting shamelessly super interested, as if she'd never ever seen a pressure cooker before, and Robbie was the genius who invented it. Women look their stupidest when they have a crush on a guy who's out of their league, and Octavia suspected that was what she was seeing. "Hi, I'm Eva," the tall girl said when she noticed Octavia watching her. Upon closer inspection, Eva was big, in both the right and wrong places. Not fat, per se, but proportionately large, awkwardly assembled on a towering frame. Her awful white t-shirt and cargo pants were a non-starter, but the subtle lipstick, chipped nail polish, messy long hair all vaguely evoked something more feminine than Eva might have intended. She was obviously careless and unrefined, but even then, one could see the potential. She reminded Octavia of a Greek statue in progress, before all the extra marble had been chipped away. "Hi, I'm Octavia," she said, arm outstretched as she angled around the center island. Octavia liked to be the prettiest woman in the room whenever possible, and it was no contest here. Especially when she was wearing her canary-yellow Betsy Johnson swing dress, she was one of the few women she knew who could truly pull off canary-yellow. Her gold and lapis lazuli earrings, an ethnic-inspired, chunky-coiled snake bracelet, and 2 big, show-stopping lapis lazuli cocktail rings, one on each middle finger. Robbie asserted himself between them. "Octavia is a fixture at the Sunday dinners I was telling you about." "Cool beans," Eva said. That kind of enthusiasm was grating, but Eva was probably still young enough to correct it later. "What do you make?" "Oh, nothing crazy. A little of this, a little of that," Octavia said. "She's dissembling," Robbie said. "She makes, let's call them, sexy versions of old-school comfort food. Remind me what they were, I don't remember." Octavia said, "Black truffle oil mac and cheese with bacon and smoked gouda. Gnocchi gratin with pecorino cheese, walleye casserole with homemade cream of mushroom soup." "Real cool," Eva said. Robbie looked at Octavia as he nudged Eva with his elbow. "This one works in the kitchen at Bar Garocha." Octavia was actually impressed. BG, as everyone called it, was the hottest tapas bar in the cities. Anderson Cooper had recently been spotted eating there. Joe Biden brought his party there after an afternoon fundraiser in 2008, and several of the most influential local food blogs had ranked it among the best in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the Midwest. All of this conspired to make its dashing executive chef into a budding star. And what this gawky work in progress was doing there made Octavia mighty curious. "You work for Mitch Diego?" she asked Eva. "With him, yes. And how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?" "I just turned 20." "Wow, you're a baby," Octavia said. That explained a lot. Now Octavia wondered if she should just feel sorry for her. "What exactly do you do there?" "I'm a sous chef, for now." For now. Octavia couldn't believe the little ingenue. Like anyone her age could possibly do better. "Well, what an impressive place to work," she said. "What's he like as a person?" "Mitch? He's okay." "That's all? He's okay?" Eva shrugged. "When he's in the kitchen, he just kind of puts the finishing touches on everything. I don't talk to him that much." "But to work with his food every day, you must love everything on the menu." "Given the ingredients, it's all right. I do my best to help it along." Damn. Given the ingredients, it's all right. If she said that in front of Mitch, Octavia believed, Eva would never even boil pasta in this town again. Baby girl needed to get spanked, big time. "Well," Octavia said, "I'm sure he appreciates whatever it is you do." Octavia sat in Robbie's lush backyard, in a crate-and-barrel deck chair next to Robbie's honey-crisp apple tree, while her bitchy, judgmental ex-roommate Maureen O'Brien smoked a cigarette and ashed it onto the lawn. Christ, Octavia thought. Why did Robbie still invite Maureen to his parties? Because she worked at a cool restaurant? Because he wanted his parties to look busier? It couldn't be because he actually liked her. It was too bad Maureen wasn't a lesbian with the buzz cut and the truck driver paunch and the sirloin thick hands. She even held her cigarettes down at waist level, palm downward like a dude, instead of arching her elbow and wrist, palm toward the sky, cigarette tip pointed downward like a woman of a refined caste. "So what's your friend's deal?" Octavia asked. She's inside forcing Robbie to explain every single item in his kitchen. I hope to God she doesn't like him. "Eva's awesome," Maureen said, not looking at Octavia. "Leave her alone." "How'd you meet someone so young and relevant?" "We worked together at the steamboat before it closed," Maureen said. "Why'd they close? Breaking child labor laws?" Maureen sucked on her cigarette and blew its plume toward the ground. "That chick has the most sophisticated palate I've ever seen. But can she cook?" Maureen looked down at Octavia and extinguished her cigarette against the side of the apple tree. "Like you wouldn't believe." A few days later, when Octavia saw that Robbie had added a seventh email address, Eva Torvalds, to the Sunday night dinner party email chain, she felt that she'd have to bring her A-game to show the newcomer what's what. On Wednesday, when everyone had to disclose what they were making, Octavia waited for everyone else to chime in before making her announcement. Robbie, open-faced Kobe beef sliders, chipotle mayo. Sarah Vong, termites on a log, hemp seeds on hummus on celery. Lacey Deitch, jello salad, smiley face. Adam Snelling, Corsican-style Paris breast. Eva Torvald, Caesar salad. Elodie Pickett, Cabernet Sauvignon, Walla Walla, for sliders. Sauternes, France, for Paris breast. Vermentino, Sardinia, for Caesar salad. Octavia, my famous summer heirloom tomato casserole, bitches. Elodie, me again. Sangiovese, Umbria, for a tomato hot dish. They'd only been doing the Sunday night dinner party every other Sunday for 3 months, but this was looking like a typical menu. The idea was, everyone was supposed to put a new twist on a familiar item, but the only people who consistently did that were Octavia and Sarah Vong, who usually brought something cheaper and easier to make than what Octavia brought. Robbie came up with the idea for the theme, but routinely ignored it. Instead, just making whatever he wanted to eat. Adam, who worked at a bakery in Lindale, always only brought bread. And Elodie, the aspiring sommelier, came through with wine pairings. There were a few problems with Octavia's high school friend Lacey Deitch. First of all, she was the mother of a newborn, a little, bald, bug-eyed girl named Emma, that she brought to all of the meals, strapped to her chest like a parasitic twin. If Octavia had known in advance that Lacey would insist on being with this creature all of the time, not once leaving the baby home with her husband, she'd never have extended the invite. No one else at the Sunday night dinner party had kids or was even married. Also, Lacey either didn't get the spirit of the theme or outright ignored it, bringing cloying, straight-up comfort food right out of a Lutheran grandma's cookbook. She was first invited in March, after Octavia noticed on social media that she was working as a part-time server at Hutmacher's, an old-school, old-money bistro on Lake Minnetonka, close to where they grew up. It was sad to confirm that a person could work at Hutmacher's and have none of the class or talent in its kitchen rub off on them at all. But Octavia liked her. They were on the volleyball team together back in the day, and held out hope that Lacey would one day bring something competent or edible. The following Sunday night dinner party, as it turned out, would not be that day. "Hey, guys," Lacey said, her naturally curly red hair glowing in the evening's golden hour, the sunlight bedazzling the red cellophane over a glass bowl of wobbling green strangeness. Lacey was a glow of color and happiness that no one besides her husband ever wanted. She was upbeat and harmless as an educational toy, and it was never insincere. In fact, she was a one-woman plague of sincerity, the patient zero of earnest zeal. Though one could imagine it might have helped her career as a waitress. In social situations, her personality made you hate the world and hate life. "I brought Jell-O," Lacey said, "with shredded carrots on the top." "And that's a new twist on comfort food how?" Octavia asked. Lacey shrugged. "It's comfort food with carrots," she said, and brought it into the kitchen. Robbie, dressed in skinny jeans and a black polo shirt with a popped collar, which all somehow worked for him, smiled at Octavia as he brought them each a Pimm's cup with muddled cucumber. "Hey, good news," he said. "An old business associate of mine just bought investment property in Bali. Seems like a good place to hole up and pound out the memoir, you know." She didn't remember putting her hand on her heart, but it was there. "Oh, when would that be?" "He's going to renovate it first, so maybe late September." "What about when you need to interview people or fact-check or do research?" Robbie shrugged. "I don't need to do any of that. It's a memoir. However I remember things is the truth. That's what's so great about it." "How long will you be gone for?" "I don't know. If I like the place, maybe years. I'll rent this place out and live on the proceeds." "Oh, my God." She was still processing all this and didn't know what to say. "Everyone will really miss you." Robbie winked at her. "Then we might as well party." At that moment, there was a knock on the door, and Elodie opened it to find Eva standing there in a plain white sleeveless blouse and tan skirt, holding a wooden bowl in a canvas bag. She had a smile of relief. "Wow, I'm glad I remembered the house," she said. Octavia helped Eva carry her stuff into the kitchen, where Octavia's summer heirloom tomato casserole was keeping warm in the oven. Eva sniffed the air and smiled. "Smells delicious," she said. "I know, doesn't it?" Octavia said. "I based it off a recipe from Petite Noisette. I made a lot of my own tweaks, though." Eva looked blankly back at Octavia at the mention of the hottest new underground food blog in the relevant world. Octavia loved that Eva hadn't heard of it. "Oh, nice," Eva said. "What kind of tomatoes did you use?" "Early Girl," Octavia said. "They're my favorite early growth heirloom." "Early Girl isn't an heirloom. It's an intentional F1 hybrid." "No, it's an heirloom." "No, it's owned by Monsanto. They're fine tomatoes, but if you want an early growth heirloom, I like Moskvich. They're exactly the same size, same globe, same indeterminate vine. everything. Heirloom Johnny Lau has them right now at the St. Paul Farmers Market. They grow up here in Zone 4B just fine. You just have to plant them in warm soil, and I'd start the seeds indoors in bisected eggshells. Octavia had quit listening after Monsanto, and Eva finally noticed this. "Sorry," Eva said. "I'm rambling." "Well, you sure know your tomatoes," Octavia said. "I used to grow San Marzanos myself because they were the best for paste." "I used to grow them, too, as a teenager down in Iowa," Eva said, "and I quit for probably the same reason. Aren't there much better paste tomatoes now? You got Jersey Giant, Opalka, Amish paste. Isn't it a huge relief that the reign of the San Marzano is finally over?" "Let's go see what everyone else is doing," Octavia said, leaving the kitchen. Robbie didn't have chairs for his dining room table. He had two long benches, so there was no head of the table, just people sitting across from each other, like in a school cafeteria. At this dinner, Octavia sat across from Robbie, Eva sat across from Elodie, and Adam Snelling, a pearl snap plaid shirt-wearing guy who was kind of cute but too quiet, and Sarah Vong, who wore loud colors and had an obvious knockoff designer handbag, sat across from each other. Because they were now seven, Lacey sat at the end, facing no one, her swaddled child flung across her chest. Eva insisted on preparing the Caesar salad at the table, which seemed to Octavia like an ostentatious demand for someone at their first Sunday night dinner party. But Robbie confirmed that this was the way the first Caesar salad in history was prepared. So Octavia let it slide. Eva rubbed the sides of the wooden bowl with bisected cloves of porcelain garlic and prepared the dressing, a mixture of Koroniki olive oil, warm coddled free-range brown egg yolks, Worcestershire sauce, freshly ground Madagascar black peppercorns, one freshly diced porcelain clove, and a bit of Meyer lemon juice. She placed single, whole romaine leaves on everyone's plates and drizzled the dressing over them, topping each with four homemade sourdough bread croutons. "Wait," said Sarah Vong, who until this point had watched in awe. She was tiny and had cute, clunky hipster princess glasses, but canceled out her demure appearance with her loud, squeaky voice. "Where's the anchovies and the cheese?" Robbie leaned forward over the table. "Caesar Cardini's original Caesar salad didn't have cheese or anchovies," he said. "Obviously Eva knew that already," Octavia said. She saw Eva smile to herself briefly. "Well, I know it's not everyone's favorite version of the Caesar," Eva said, "but yeah, it goes back to the 1920s. Octavia saw that Eva looked at the floor as everyone took their first bites. "Oh my God," Elodie said. "This is insane." "Damn," said Sarah, licking her fork. "Wow," said Robbie, his jaws full of romaine and croutons, his lips shiny with thick Koroniki oil. "It's official. She's coming to every dinner." Everyone else concurred. Eva smiled and thanked them softly. Remembering Eva's snotty tomato lecture and previous sharp talk about Mitch Diego, Octavia wasn't buying the humble act. Inevitably, one day, Eva would overreach and expose her inexperience and vulnerability in devastating fashion. And Octavia would decide then whether to swoop in and rescue her. But until then, she was forced into the exhausting task of helping her village correctly raise this arrogant child. "It's a real nice salad course," Octavia said at last. "I imagine it's easy to make a great salad with such expensive ingredients, though." Robbie looked from Octavia to Eva. "Those aren't expensive ingredients, I would know. Did you see her make it? It's freshness, proportions, timing, am I right?" Eva shrugged and nodded. "I almost forgot the wine," said Elodie, rising, and returned from the kitchen with an open bottle of Vermentino. "Don't finish your salads yet." For most of the table, it was too late. Although Sarah Vong valiantly initiated a heated argument about the quality of food trucks, offering as her sole evidence the popularity of a single gourmet food truck in Los Angeles, the conversation kept looping back to Eva's ridiculous salad. With each course that came out that night, Somebody made some reference to why the dish wasn't prepared at the table or where were the Madagascar peppercorns. Octavia's famous summer heirloom tomato casserole barely even got a mention. By the time Lacey Deitch's unappealing jello salad came out, which looked like congealed aquarium water with dead goldfish shredded on the surface, no one was hungry for anything except more chatter about that stupidly basic Caesar. Then something happened that made Octavia want to cut herself. On her way to the bathroom, she glanced into the kitchen and saw Robbie kissing Eva on the cheek. It was on the cheek, but it was a kiss. And Robbie had his eyes closed, and Eva did too. Eva did not deserve this. Robbie had had a dining room full of attractive, smart, tipsy women, women close to his age, who had accomplished something with their lives, at his place for the last 3 months. And this smart-ass tomato girl is who he chooses? Worse, now Eva would be driving home tonight, imagining herself cooking meals in Robbie's kitchen, making pie from the apples in his backyard, lounging with a cocktail on his white mid-century modern sofa, making love in his four-poster bed, the feel of his smooth lips lingering on her face until the moment her eyes closed on the memory. Yes, Octavia could obviously see what Eva saw in Robbie. Aside from the money and the superficial aspects, he was quite literally a gateway to a more sophisticated adult world. Were people Eva's age having dinner parties like this one? Hardly. The Sunday night dinner party was, except for poor Lacey Deitch, a carefully curated assemblage of experts who were at the top of their respective games. Not even Maureen O'Brien was ever invited, and not because she was petty and unattractive, it was because she didn't do any one thing well enough. Eva must have understood what a privilege it was to receive Robbie's invitation, and now that she'd also been handpicked from among more worthy adversaries for the affection of the most desirable bachelor Octavia could ever dream up, well, that girl must be melting like sugar on his tongue. What Robbie got out of it was harder for Octavia to figure, and it would be a while before she realized that he hadn't chosen Octavia or Elodie or Sarah because to choose an equal would be a sign of maturity. And this boy did not want to grow up, at least not yet. Octavia hoped Eva would be his last roll in the hay before he finally realized that these young girls had nothing to offer but ignorance and demands. Octavia, who had grown up in Minnetonka around people with both money and taste, who had degrees in English and sociology from Notre Dame, whose dad was a corporate lawyer and stepmother was a model-turned-pharmaceutical sales rep, was meant to marry a man like Robbie Kramer. She didn't even want a better life than the one she grew up with. She didn't need to be wealthier, just comfortable, with a husband like Robbie who valued the same lifestyle. She would be happy, she knew, being his plus one to political fundraisers and charming the less intelligent wives of his prospective business partners. She'd even learned to play golf, knew how to make 27 cocktails, and could watch a Minnesota Vikings game and understand it without asking questions. She knew how to be around rich men, and it was heartbreaking to see Robbie waste himself, for now, on some wide-eyed, guileless little no-name kid. "Think I'm going to call it a night, you guys," Octavia said. She badly needed to decompress after that dinner. When she went home, she did something she'd never done before. She took a few hits off her housemate's bowl. That April, Octavia wanted to move somewhere closer to her job in Uptown, so she rented the second floor of a house from a divorced 29-year-old woman named Andrea, who worked for a theater company and smoked up while watching HBO. From the first-floor kitchen, which they shared, Octavia glanced into the living room and saw that Andrea had left her weed and pipe on the coffee table for the first time since they'd lived together. It was clearly meant to be. It was like her housemate knew. The following week ended up being just about the worst 5-day stretch of Octavia's adult life to that point. There was a random drug test at the children's educational nonprofit where she worked, which she failed because she'd done drugs for the first time in years just 36 hours before. and was immediately put on administrative leave without pay, which pretty much meant that she was fired. As a result, her dad cut her off financially, saying he wouldn't give her another check until she checked into Hazleton and tackled the drug addiction he claimed he'd always suspected she had. "You fucking bastard," she said to her dad on the phone, and hung up, tears in her eyes. To his credit, he'd left her alone after that. But now, with no job and no money from home, Octavia Kincaid was